Welcome back to Empower with Emma, with me, Emma Kyo. Today, I have the most inspiring and crazy story I've ever heard of my whole entire life. Not only did this move me, did this shake me, did it make my whole being vibrate. My emotion was in my throat when I heard this story. When I heard this man's story about being incarcerated on death row for 23 years, living with himself, being in solitary confinement, being stripped of everything, being abused, literally, you name it, this man has gone through it, from losing all his family to being homeless. Ladies and gents, this is Nick Yaris. So today I have on the pod probably one of the most inspirational men story that I've probably ever came across in my life. It is the most amazing story, inspirational, groundbreaking, life-changing, Nick Yaris. Welcome to the pod. Where do we even start?
How I got here.
So how did you get here? How did you get this place in your life right now? Let's go from the start.
Okay, so last October, I came to Ireland. And at first I was thinking about simple things like getting a job for DHL and working for them. But I didn't know that you'd have to have an emergency tax number and they would take 40% of your salary. So it didn't sound attractive. So I started going into Dublin, and I wanted to perform comedy for the first time in my life. So I went to the International and I nailed it. And I was so proud of myself.
Yeah.
And I started falling into this feeling. My grandmother was Irish, and all of a sudden I felt home and I felt happy here and I liked being here.
Mm.
And it was over the holiday of Halloween. And it was such a brilliant thing that I ended up, I went and did Danny O'Brien's comedy set in town, and he gave me 10 minutes to perform. And I did this great routine, and I was so proud of myself and happy. And I had just attended the Moonstock Festival where I spoke, and it was a beautiful offering for me to go into a men's tent.
Yeah.
And talk to all of the gathered men about what it took for me to come here to Ireland and do it against the backdrop of leaving my daughter's ashes at the Trinities and saying goodbye to sorrow and making a real effort, you know?
Yeah.
And even before I spoke at Moonstock, I was walking around to the vendors area and I came upon a woman who had a business that was called Be Kind. And it was Kylie Mayer. And the first thing that I remember was I had just for some reason read an article about how dangerous it is to burn candles that have scented material because it's all petrochemical.
Yeah.
And one of the natural things you should do for relaxation is burn incense, which are all natural.
Yeah.
And I had this lovely conversation with her, but I kept feeling like I knew her.
Mm.
It was that thing that we think that we recognize someone from a past, or we somehow know them. And instantly she's turned to me and said, oh, I got to just introduce you to my husband, Mark.
Yeah.
You know, my partner Mark's right here. So I start talking to Mark and everything, and I float off. And then I don't know how it happened, but I came back from speaking at that tent, like I said, in the men's tent. And by then, word was getting around the festival what I had just done.
Yeah.
And she came up to me. She's like, shit, I missed you. Yeah. I missed your talk. I was down here that I missed it. But everyone's keep telling me about you and what happened. So I spoke to her and I kept talking to her. And I knew I'd be connected to her.
Yeah.
I ended up giving a woman named Melissa a ride home from the festival to her house in Dublin. And I made all these great connections throughout the day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I went back to England. And over the course of the end of the year, I finished my brand new book called, of all things, Mind Your Heart, which is an Irish saying.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that saying here. Mm-hmm. And I love that idea. We should mind our heart.
Yeah.
Our heartstrings are tugged on by people at times unfairly or we don't guard our hearts enough to protect ourselves from hurts that we let people use us with. And I had someone say the most sweetest thing is just, instead of saying, I love you, they said, well, mind your heart. And I thought, that's the title of my new book.
Yeah.
So I finished the book over Christmas and I came here only because Kylie, who I met at Moonstock, said to me, oh, I don't know if this means anything, but we're having our first birthday party for our business and I wish you could still be here. And I said, okay, I'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah.
And she was like, what? I said, yeah.
So, and that's brilliant. Like, and here you are, but we all know you're here for a reason. You're like, your story at the Be Kind event touched so many hearts. And the story, why you're here today. Why are you here today?
I honestly believe that I have a gift of neuroplasticity healing that I can offer others to let go of PTSD.
And what gave you PTSD?
Being on death row for 23 years. Being sentenced to die for the rape and murder of a woman I never even met in my life. And being physically tortured for that fact by prison guards who felt that they had to righteously abuse me. And I actually was pushed so hard by the system that after 20 some years of solitary confinement, I asked to be executed instead of lingering on. And when I did that, I finally was granted DNA testing that proved my innocence. So I went through an enormous battle just to be a free man, just to be set free from the prison barriers. And unfortunately, unlike on television, when you see someone getting their life back, I had a whole series of tragedies waiting for me in a dysfunctional family that would soon ostracize me. And that's what I really wanted to express to people when I came to the Be Kind Festival. I wanted to tell people my situation upon release was so dire that I had a simple choice. I could either join in with my anger and start to drink and get high and give up on it all, feeling the victim. I call that feeling the victim, you know. Or I could come up with something so beautiful of mind that if I chased after that dream, it would give me a magnificence that I sought about my life. Because I felt like this. There was no way I suffered all of these amazing things of being sentenced to death at the age of 20, living the first 2 years in my cell in complete silence, escaping from death row at the age of 24, only to turn myself back in 25 days later, knowing I was not clever enough to do that, and I was innocent anyway, to going on to becoming the first man in America to seek DNA evidence to prove his innocence from death row in 1988, only to spend the next 15 years watching them destroy the evidence in an effort to murder me because they knew I was innocent. And it led me to the fact that I was so sick from a beating that they gave me, in which I contracted hepatitis C, a blood infection. I was forced to write a letter to ask to dismiss my lawyer so I could be executed rather than linger on. I was pushed that hard just to go through that, because they blinded me in my cell with medications that were so strong that the toxins killed my eyesight. And for 3 days, I thought I would spend the rest of my prison time blind. Could you imagine you enter prison at the age of 20, but you know you're a good person and everybody's trying to torture you because they think you went out and killed a woman who you thought in your mind looked like your girlfriend that gave you a hard time and broke up with you. And then you have to find a way to love yourself despite people actively trying to murder you, degrade you, humiliate you, and break you. I wasn't in a prison to be in a prison. I was in a unit meant to break you. So the average rate of survival for a human being in my prison was only 5 years. If you lived longer than 5 years on B block in Huntington State Prison in Pennsylvania, you were a superhuman being. I lasted 12 years. I watched so many men kill themselves, die of stomach cancers. It was built in the 1800s. It was the old style, the Shawshank Redemption kind of looking prison. And the rule was, if you attacked another officer or inmate in a prison in Pennsylvania, they sent you to Huntington to break you. Their whole regimen was about breaking you from being violent and combative. Get it?
Yeah.
I was there because of my sentence. I didn't do any infractions of the rules, but they subjected me to all the same torture. So at one point, they came up with gladiator school where they thought it would be fun to make us go out and fight each other in the cages. So I had to learn all these martial arts skills to keep myself alive by harming very devious murderers. And it's a fascinating feature that the one thing that made me truly dangerous in this prison later on was because I became a beacon of hope and help to other men, writing letters to their mothers because their brains were too scrambled to write a beautiful letter, or doing legal work for them, or helping them with institution problems of getting new shirts and sheets and stuff because they couldn't fill out a request form. When the eventuality of proving my innocence came about, men went on a hunger strike in defiance of their friend, Nick, being tortured all these years for something he didn't do. And they loved me so much. One of the captains had to bring me back to death row and stand on the block and tell them all to stand down. Don't hurt no officers. They're not abusing me, because rumors were flying that, you see, what do you do when you have DNA evidence that proves that your whole death penalty is a lie? You freak out. One of the ways they freaked out is they took me off of death row and they stripped me of all my books and my paintings and everything that I had to use to make myself comfortable. And they put me in a mental cell with a guard outside my cell 24 hours a day watching me so I didn't kill myself or hurt one of them.
For how long?
8 months. After I proved my innocence. And the inmates and the prisoners that I was on death row were so outraged that I was being abused that they went on a 10-day hunger strike and they threatened to assault the staff and kill the staff for what was being done to me, because rumors were flying around the prison that I was being abused. So a captain brought me over to the block and made me stand on the block and tell the other inmates they could all stand down. I wasn't being abused. I was just in isolation for my own protection. Crazy. They love me.
Yeah. And was that like your, obviously being in prison, being in the system for so long, and then, you know, being abused, you know, the guards trying to break you. Was that your first kind of sense of like love and support in that environment?
No, the crazy thing is, in 1988, at the age of 27, sitting there with 100 years plus the death penalty on top of my life, a woman named Jackie came to the prison to visit and try and interview me for a lawsuit that was being aimed at shutting down the prison. And Jackie, at the age of 32, was a psychiatric aide working with children. And she's really well together woman. And she came there with a woman named Pam Tucker to interview me about the abuses that I had to endure. And I had no complaints. And it really pissed her off. This made her really not happy. Wait a minute. I just interviewed five guys and every one of them's in there saying, they're beating on us. They're making us fight each other. You know, all their laments. I walked in and I told him I could kill for a cup of coffee. And I started talking to my friend Pam, who drove her there, and I was all happy. And I was telling him about this beautiful book, Bufo do Lobo, the Frog and the Wolf, a beautiful Spanish love story that was translated into English. And I'm blowing her mind by not even complaining. And she came back by herself the next week. And she didn't want to interview me about this lawsuit. She was really beside herself. Why am I not complaining? How can you live in hell and be tortured? And I told her I didn't have time for it. I blew her mind. So then she came back the week after that, and the week after that. And then 3 months went by, and I was trying to figure out a way to tell her not to come back. And I seriously started getting upset because I refused to tell her I was innocent. And she kept asking me, what happened? It's okay. I just want to know the truth, is what she would say. And I said, I can't. I said, you want to know why I couldn't tell her the truth?
Why?
The reason that I ended up on death row is because I embarrassingly got arrested for being in a stolen car and was falsely accused by that arresting officer of taking his gun off of him and trying to kill him. Yeah. So I made up a brutal lie about a murder that I read about in the newspaper to try and blame on a guy I thought was dead to get out of my charges. And the police twisted that all around and put me on death row knowing that I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So the most embarrassing thing of my life is I put myself on death row by making up a lie. And I was so embarrassed, I couldn't tell Jackie the truth. So I would rather let her think I murdered a woman than tell her the truth. That's how fucked up I was in my head. Sorry for the language, but I really
No,
was.
You're allowed. You're allowed. You're allowed to say that.
No, I'm so sincere, though. When I met a woman who was beautiful and attractive, who fancied me, I was so devastated by it. I tried to get out of it. And I actually refused to tell her I was innocent until I fucking got this newspaper about DNA testing. And when I did, I was like, oh, my God, I got to tell this woman that I have feelings for her. And I was terrified. So I went into the visit and I said to her, look, I got something really big to tell you. It's two things. I said, first and foremost, I think I'm in love with you. And that scares the shit out of me. And the second thing is, I just found out about this thing called DNA testing, and I can prove to you I didn't kill this woman, so I'm coming home. And she was like, fuck. Yeah.
Mental. And then, so
the
we're
next
actually
9 years, I married her wearing handcuffs. She was my wife for the next 9 years. We never had any contact visits. I only held her hands for 15 minutes throughout the whole 9 years. And then the evidence spilled in transport. I finally got granted DNA testing in 1995, 12 years later, 8 years later. And it spilled in transit and broke open. And the laboratory in California refused to test the evidence. So it looked like all the evidence was finally gone. And she came to visit me and said, look, I can't keep going. I love you. You're a beautiful man. And I've given you 9 years of my life, but my mom just died of emphysema. I have a house full of legal boxes from my husband who's on death row that I can't touch, and I can't do it no more. I have to go. So I wrote her this really beautiful letter in the aftermath of that. And I empowered her with all the special knowledge of what a gift she could be to anyone. And she should continue on being that. And then the crazy thing is, on the day that I was being set free, January 16th, 2004, she was there outside the prison. She was married to another man. And we weren't going to get our dreams, but she asked me, could she drive me to a restaurant nearby so she could talk to me before she went on her way? And I got in the car with her, and it was wonderful because I thought about how I met her, what we've been through. And I was so grateful because Jackie taught me how to speak to a woman. Jackie taught me how to become a man. You have to understand, I was 20 years old when I went to prison, and I had no developmental skills to become mature as a man. And I didn't really have an understanding of how completely energetically different a woman speaks than a man, and how I had to learn the language of femininity, she taught me. A lot of men don't have a clue, but there's a real understanding that there is a language of femininity that women express that men are obtuse to unless they let a woman teach them how to become a man.
Amen.
Yeah. So Jackie taught me how to become a man, and the responsibilities of my masculinity against the control of my own stupid anger, and how a macho man is not an angry man. A macho man is an insecure man.
He doesn't know what their own feelings.
Well, they have it's called a brusque facade that they need to emulate because of the fear factor that they might be found out to be soft.
Yeah.
Whereas a soft man has the confidence to come across as soft because underneath is a real man.
That's a very powerful statement.
It has to come from maturity. It has to come from experience. I know. I get it.
And then navigating then through that love, how did that navigate you then when you were in prison? Like, you know, how did that, you know, fuel? Because like you were
in
prison. I was
happy. I spent almost 9 full years completely happy on death row. I was in love.
Yeah.
I was writing 10-page letters. You know what the analogy I made it to? It was like I was in a wheelchair and someone was in love with me. They could understand it. A person right now who's incapacitated and has to live in a wheelchair understands my love affair.
Yeah.
I couldn't be her lover physically, but I was her lover in every possible life sense. And this woman was completely satisfied, happy. And that was wonderful because I was so intuitively paying attention to her development. I was her world as a man should be. I had the time for it. And she taught me how to be what? Mature. And
that's amazing. But it's so beautiful as well, the way even that, do you think that fueled you then for your own self-love and your hope to keep going when you were in prison as well, you know, with the abuse you were encountering, you know, not giving up? Like, how did that impact you?
The crazy thing is, you have to understand, I went to prison completely hateful of me, willing to destroy myself in drugs and alcohol and hatred every chance I got, right? Because when I was a 7-year-old boy, a man raped me and beat my head in with a rock and left me with brain damage. So I despised myself. It wasn't until someone was threatening to murder me for something I didn't do that I found the ability to love myself enough to finally tell my parents what happened to me at the age of 24. But it took someone trying to degrade me and ruin me and tell me what a piece of crap that I was that made me find love enough, strong enough for myself to tell my parents, listen to me. I want you to know that when I was a 7-year-old little boy, this is what happened. And my mother's reaction was, oh, thank God. Oh, my God, thank God. I thought I was a bad mother. I thought I let you down. My secret destroyed them.
Really?
They thought they failed me because why else would their kid be a tearaway, chunky trunk who wouldn't talk to us and hated himself? How could a child feel that way about themselves? We must be terrible parents.
Yeah.
And then she was free. And she was happy.
But
and
you
she
weren't
was proud
free.
Of me. Oh, I was free from it then. Because once I learned how to love myself, nothing stopped me. I started this beautiful education thing where 9,400 books later, I quit counting 6 years of psychology. My mother looked at me and said, you're a beautiful person, Nikki. Don't you see that? And I didn't, but I believed enough in her eyes to believe it. Get it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Women understand that because they don't feel beautiful. But when a man makes them feel beautiful, they want to believe in that man's eyes.
But it's learning to embody it, isn't it? Really embody your own self.
My mother watched me go from my trial at the age of 21 with a three-day trial, which was a mockery and being defeated, to walking into a courthouse 9 years later and educating the court on mitochondrial DNA. Mm-hmm. I was the foremost knowledgeable person on the planet about DNA because I was pen pals with Sir Alec Jeffries, who invented the science. I mean, I put in the work. So I made my mother proud of me, despite being in prison. And it was she that came to me and said, stop fighting. She said, I can't have you fight no more. Every time I come here, you're bandaged up or you're broken bones or something. Stop doing it, Nikki, because you're beating on corpses. And I'm out here trying to get you set free. And if you kill somebody in here, what am I doing? I'm wasting my time. So I literally at one point had to close my hands and willingly let myself not get into a fight. And it was so hard.
Yeah.
But I did it. Yeah. And I've lived through having so many stabbing attacks and beatings. It's just, it was very difficult to be passively strong, I call it.
Yeah.
But I pulled it off. And know what I did?
Yeah.
I started using love.
You've been the total opposite, like the total opposite of what you were doing.
I couldn't do this no more, right?
Yeah.
So I figured it out. I remember I helped a guy named Running Bear get his sentence changed from the death penalty to a third degree. So he had a 30-year sentence, but he had a chance to get out. He was only arrested at 18, got him on his way. Then I helped Lonnie Baker get his sentence overturned. And then the next one was, I started working on men who I knew had mental disabilities and they couldn't write beautiful letters to their mom or coherent letters to their lawyer. Mm-hmm. Now imagine you got this guy in the cell next to you who will listen to you talk and he'll write this beautiful letter to your lawyer and your lawyer will write you back and say to you, oh my God, that man was so right. And then I had a following of men on the block who looked to me for their mental acuity to have enough resources to get through that day based on me being there.
This sounds like the Green Mile.
I know I heard some shit like that before.
Or like the Shawshank, really, do you know that way when you had the guy like helping people? Yeah.
Yeah, but I had a choice, didn't I?
Yeah, you did, yeah.
I had a choice to use my beautifully owned autodidactic accumulation of an education that took me well past the norms to turn around and build other men up. And this is what made me so dangerous at the end, that the captain had to take me over to the block and tell him, I'm not being abused, guys, stand down, because they really thought that they were going to murder me. When you're being sentenced to death and you see this death penalty from inside the cell, and then you witness a man about to prove his innocence with DNA science. Mm. You could have felt the fear back then because I was the very first one. And it was like proven that the whole death penalty was bullshit. They can get it wrong.
Yeah.
So out of that, the vicious rumors was they took Nick out the H block and they were going to murder him. And the guys were really fearful of it. And I was their boy. And they were like, no, hell no. You ain't taking out Nikki, man. We love that guy, man.
They were like your little guardian angels as well. Like they were really looking out for you, weren't they?
Yeah. And these are influential figures. One man named Craig had 400 soldiers under him from the Junior Black Mafia in Philadelphia. A very powerful figure. You don't mess with me because Craig's got my back. You get it? Yeah. Because I wrote beautiful letters to Craig's mom. I did hustles for Craig and I got his mom sent flowers or something. I was always that guy. Mm. Yeah. No, the thing that struck me was I didn't care the first time I watched a man kill himself in front of me. Mm. I couldn't allow myself to care. And then I got changed by an event where a man named Peanut didn't want to go home. He had been in prison serving a 15-year sentence for violent assault on his own father because his father was abusing his mother, as he had been doing their whole marriage. And Peanut was in the vents, they call it. He was talking to me through the vent, and it was his last night, and they were forcing him out after 15. He did the whole 15. And I was like, Nut, what are you going to do, man? And he's like, Nick, I can't. I can't go home and break my mother's heart, because as soon as I get to the house, I'm going to fuck him up.
Yeah.
Because while he was in prison, he separated her shoulder. He did a lot of damage to his Peanut's mom. And Peanut was this really cool, light-skinned black dude from West Philly, and he was really sweet. He was a nice guy. But I understood. He wasn't a criminal. He was in there because he beat up his father with a bat because his father broke his mom's jaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said to him that night, craziest thing. I said to him, Peanut, you're an instrument of God. What are you doing, man? I said, you got to be righteous in your heart for what you do and don't worry about consequences. Or you got to be righteous in your heart for what you don't do and don't do a thing. I said, but it's still down to you to recognize you're an instrument of God, whatever it is. And then he hung himself. And the fucking guards came by and I was devastated because I don't know if I triggered it by saying that.
Yeah.
So after that, because I ended up watching 11 people kill themselves, man. It's hard to explain, but I've seen people cut their, like, look me in the eye and cut their own throats. Jump off the tier, land at my feet. I can't undo them. I can't unfeel for them. I can't unhear the noise of a body flopping down on concrete from 30 feet up. So I died. I just decided, fuck that. I'm going to start helping. Like, I'm not letting these dudes take themselves out. I'm tired of this. Why do I have to feel all this emotional turmoil because this dude doesn't have no one to talk to him, so he kills himself?
Yeah.
Why do I have to feel like this is me next? Maybe I'll... So I said, fuck it. I'm going to talk to everybody. And I was the joker, and I pulled pranks on dudes, and I got into their heads. And I got them to open up to me. And I don't care that they killed someone. I wasn't there. I can't judge them. I don't care what they did. I cared who they were. When they weren't on drugs and on booze and shit, and I dealt with them, they were different. They were this human being. And a lot of them had contrition in their heart that I dealt with. Now, I did filter out the evil. You understand? There are real evil in this world. And I've dealt with them. I filter them out. When I recognize there's a certain type, I won't go there and I will dismiss them and I won't have anything to say to you. Okay?
Yeah.
Don't acknowledge them because it feeds the evil. But I went through this really cool metamorphosis of being an empathy-driven gentleman in the most chaotic hellhole you could imagine. And I mastered it.
Yeah.
I did. I nailed it. I had
you deserve a Nobel Peace Prize or something.
No, but see, this is a crazy thing. I only had one duty. They're going to execute me. I want to be the baddest man ever who walks into the death chamber with the most beautiful, composed death speech, so that I could eloquently end my life. That was my whole goal. I never thought I'd see you and talk to you. I never knew any of this stuff was going to be real. I had one duty. I was going to be executed, and I wasn't going to embarrass myself.
Yeah.
I grew up in Southwest Philadelphia, and it's like the hardest edges of Dublin. There is a guttural, disrespectful communication of language. Nothing purposeful, nothing beautiful. If you notice, I don't say the word is not a word. I don't say ah. I don't need to make a sound. I'm fully faculty aware of the words I need to choose and then use because they might be my last.
Yeah.
So when I decided I was going to come up with a death speech, I went next level. I liken myself to a beautiful neutrino that emanates from the earth and passes through the hardest substances that we know of without yielding. And that I, like a neutrino, was being held by them with their ignorance of not knowing who I truly was. And that in my capacity of humanity, I could forgive them for murdering me. And I hoped that they could have compassion for the loss that I was from life.
Wow. And
Isn't
here you
that what
are.
you do? Yeah. I
And
never
here you
got
are.
the need to make that speech, right?
And is that 20 years ago now?
That is 20 years ago on the 16th of this month.
I was
walked
about to
out
say
of the
that. So
prison.
it's a week today.
I know. I'm releasing my brand new book called Mind Your Heart, Nick Yarris, 20 Years of Freedom from Death Row, because I made it, kid. Now, people aren't going to like this part, but the 20 years of freedom have been harder than all of my death row days.
How so?
Let's see. There's the physical presence of my daughter dying at 6 months old in my arms. There's the loss and the crowd stalking I endure from an ex-partner who's taken my other daughter, Lara Rebecca. I haven't seen her in 11 years. The millions of pounds that I lost from devious acts from others. The driven need to crowd stalk and hurt me, in some convoluted need to get revenge for me leaving them. That's what a stalker seeks. So I had the embarrassing factor all along that my daughter, Lara Rebecca, who will be 18 years of age in April, is fully aware that her mother is a psychotically driven stalker.
Yeah, that's a lot. And then obviously navigating your life now. So from someone who, like
I've been
you said,
homeless for the last 4 years. My
okay.
wife got addicted to drugs in America. One of the parts of PTSD is sometimes people aren't strong enough to avoid the pitfalls of drugs. So I lost my children with her that I was raising. I ended up living in the forest for the last 3.5 years. I'm currently homeless. I do podcasts for sustenance. Otherwise, I'm just waiting for projects that I've been working for years now to finally come in and I'll get stability. But even as I sit here today with composure, I have no sustenance. I'm homeless. I live out of a vehicle. And I only came to Ireland because I met two really kind people at a festival who heard my message and wanted to share it.
And
And
like
I
you,
love it.
yeah.
I'm living one of the greatest lives ever.
And like a big thing for me, what you said when I was in that like talk as well was like, you know, you were saying how the 27 boys or men, that you were the only one
from
that
my
was
neighborhood.
Allowed. Yeah.
God saved my life by sending me to death row. The courthouse was struck by lightning the day I was sentenced to die.
What?
It's a physiological fact. Look it up. Yes, ma'am. On the day that the jury was finding me guilty for a murder that I didn't do, the courthouse got struck by lightning and all the power went out. And they took me out of the courtroom at gunpoint, thinking I had somehow orchestrated an escape attempt. And they took me upstairs and they put me in this big empty cell overlooking the courtyard below. And since there was no power for air conditioning or anything, everything was quiet. And as I stood looking down on all of these people from my neighborhood, people who I had sleepovers with their children or they knew me from my children, they looked up and they saw me and they started giving me the jeering looks and gestures, you know. And all of a sudden in my head, I heard this voice tell me to turn around and look everyone in the eye. Don't be afraid. Look them in the eye. Kept hearing it. So I did. I walked back in the courthouse and I went back into that cell. From that cell into the courtroom. And when the judge pronounced me to death plus 60 years, he couldn't look me in the eye. And I kept looking him in the eye and I kept telling him, look at me. You can't look at me because you know I didn't do this.
Yeah.
That's why your head is down. Then when he asked me, he said, do you have anything else to say? I said, yes, sir, you can go to hell. So he said, okay, I'm going to send you to hell. There you go.
Yeah, like.
But yeah, how about that? I endured attacks in prison where I should have been murdered several times, and I survived. I've been stabbed multiple times. I shouldn't be here, man, but I pulled it out. God was with me.
Yeah.
I was stabbed so deep by one man, I had to headbutt him to get me off me.
You're here for a
Fascinating.
reason, though. You're here for
Yes,
a reason.
ma'am. Yes,
Like
ma'am.
100%. Like you have so many, like, you know, the 27, you know, men from your neighborhood. You're the only one that's alive from, and, you know, being
And both
protected.
both my brothers were in that photograph.
Oh.
So they're both dead. My little
Sorry,
brother
dude.
Marty died of a drug overdose while I was on death row. And then my brother Mikey died once I got out. So I get it. I am an orphan now. My father died this past year in 2023. My mom's gone. So I have this weird thing where I'll probably live to be about 90 like my father. But I worry about my cognitive faculties because of this thing CTE I've been diagnosed with.
Yeah.
It's a cognitive degenerative disease brought on by head trauma.
Okay.
A lot of rugby players understand it and NFL players. That's
Yes.
why I wanted,
Yes.
yeah, a young man named Sam wants me to work with a rugby team here in Ireland and help them with suicide and in between game performance development called neuroplasticity sports healing. And I really want to come to Ireland and try and get housing and set up and work with this team to get a message across to the youth of Ireland not to kill yourself. I'm so hurt that this island represents one of the top five in the world rates of suicide in the developmental Western world.
Yeah.
And it's across the spectrum from blue collar to university level. These are the highest rates of suicide in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So I have a gift. And God gave me a gift to get people not to kill themselves. And I want to use that gift here in Ireland. And I'm going to show through the performance of this rugby team being champion year in and year out because they're building up their brothers with neuroplasticity. I'm going to leave a legacy here for children not to kill themselves.
Definitely.
And I'm working on a documentary right now with Alex Rotoli called Why Don't You Just Kill Yourself? And it's about his cancer journey of 10 years being homeless. I met a man 3.5 years ago while I myself was homeless. And I promised him I was going to tell this beautiful story about his life and we're going to do it.
Yeah, like you said, you only said to me as well, like, and you said it at the talk. To be kind, and you said it off air, but you're going to say it now is like, say you're saying about ask about the no.
Yeah, the answer is always no unless you ask.
And like, even asking you, I was like, oh, I just need to talk to him because I've never been so moved by someone, like I said to you. And then even when I heard your story, and then I was like, I wonder, could he get on my podcast? I was like, because I just think you're going to touch the hearts of so many people. And I do think it's going to be like a ripple effect. And I can already see you like here that it's just about being kind and just reaching out and just taking that chance and not giving up. And I think you're such a martyr for that. Like, how do you keep going? Like, how do you keep going? Like, your outlook.
You ready?
Yeah.
It's called The One.
Okay.
All right. At that festival, there was one person that walked up to me and said, literally, Nick, you saved my life today. And he means it. You and I sitting here talking, Emma, we're looking for that one. And she or he knows exactly what I'm hitting on right now.
Yeah.
You and I talking are going to change the dynamics inside them so much they're not going to hurt themselves anymore. They're going to start to change this self-harming abuse they've been on. And right now, she probably crying her heart out, where he's got a lump in his throat so hard he can't help it. But you're the one. And that's the one that you and I are searching for.
Yes.
As long as I can go out and I can find the one, honey, I'll come back and I'll keep talking and I'll keep making documentaries and I'll keep helping people because I was the one. You, Emma, were the one at one point waiting for that message. And you didn't think it was going to come to you. And you thought, never, I'll fucking get out of this head of mine.
Yeah.
But then you heard the message and you no longer are the one.
Yeah.
Now your gift is to find the one. Pablo Picasso said, the meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of your life is to give that gift away.
I agree.
And this is why I honestly am answering you fully when I tell you, I'm looking for the one. That one person I haven't reached yet who needs to hear my message, who will helpfully then change the lives of their children or their loved ones and their friends and their husbands or whatever it is. Me and you touched that one today, and I promise you, he or she will reach out and tell you they heard this part especially. Okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't even think, like, I think that's just like the best ending ever. There's no point of me pushing this. It's like, just really what you said there about the one, I think that's so valid because that is actually my mantra in life as well. So the reason why I do what I do is because if I only touch one person, my job is done.
No way.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I always say just one. If I just am here and only one person shows up, it's one. It's better than none. One is better than none.
Yeah. I always say I'm looking for the ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I know within statistical studies, if I put together 100 people, 10 of them have unimaginable, unresolved trauma.
Yeah.
If I can get those 10 people to even come down for, if it's a single one of them, and I can get into that group, I know I'm going to come away with a lifelong love affair with that person. Yeah. Emma, for the rest of my life, I will now love you because what did we do? Mm. We showed everyone what it's like to seek one.
Yeah.
And to acknowledge that we were the ones seeking and we were grateful enough when we found it to expound upon it now, right?
100%.
That's all we're doing. That's all we're doing. For the one person who sees this podcast and heard within my voice an honesty, where you looked into the lovely eyes of Emma and you saw her reflect back to you what you are, listen to that. Because it's real. Why do you think the hairs on your body are standing up right at this moment? Because you're hearing a truth. And the truth is harmonizing within the truth within you, which is a perfect receptor of the truth. Mm-hmm. You can never lie so good that you can get a person to have chills on their arms and neck. Only the truth will raise that honesty.
Yeah.
So for those of you around the world who watch and listen to Emma, thank you for sharing with me this portion. And please know that I will guide her and love her much like you guys try to do with your support from this moment on.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart to yours. As always, I have tears in my eyes. But like your words, the way you talk, I feel you're going to touch so many people's hearts as well. And I think the biggest thanks from my heart to yours, and I'm giving you that energy. Where can people follow you and follow your journey if you want to share that?
I only use Instagram for now. And okay. I'll release the book on Amazon, on Kindle and stuff.
Mind Your Heart at Amazon. And where can people follow you on Instagram? What's your handle?
Nick Yaris. I never use names. You know, okay. My parents named me correctly.
Exactly. So there you go. Ladies and gents, Nick Yaris.
Thank you, Emma. Brilliant. Well done, babe.
Well, what an episode. Like, number one, I'm on an absolute high from just the energy, the story, the empowerment. Like, I've never heard anything like that before. And I just had to get Nick on my podcast. He's due to go home to Reading. He lives over there in the UK in his camper van. And he actually decided to jump on the pod. Like, I did what I could. But I wanted to finish my season with him. And I was like, if you don't ask, the answer is no. And that's exactly the saying in life. And a big thing, which I hope you take from this podcast, is exactly what Nick said. It's the one. It's showing kindness. It's showing up with love. It's touching one person. That ripple effect, that is what life is about. It's just not only showing up for yourself, but helping others, learning to help others, even if you are suffering. And like, from my heart to yours, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting, as always. And definitely follow Nick and his story and even his book when he releases it as well. So thank you so much, and thanks for listening in. I will see you next week for my last solo episode of the season with Empower with Emma. And of course, as always, if you could like, subscribe, follow, I would love that so, so much. It would mean the world to me. And you can follow me on Instagram, which is at Emma Kyo, or my Empower with Emma handle as well. Thank you so much. Hope you have a great week.